when we do another edition of this book, we're going to change the title and change the cover. The title is going to be The Secret Beekeepers Don't Want You to Know. I love it. It's just, I think it'll just sell like hotcakes. Because, you know, it's like everybody's going to go, beekeepers have a secret. And what is it? And then you got to read the book and find out what it is. And then on the cover, we're going to have this. You've seen, like, on the nature programs, the beekeeping white coveralls. We're going to have this babe in white coveralls that's going to be, like, unzipped down the front. So we got some cleavage, and then she's holding a gun. And it's like, see, that way, you know, she's holding a gun because she doesn't want you to know the secret. I take it from your lap, you like it. That is good. Do you design books? Yeah, I'll put you in contact with my publisher. I want to reflect on that image a little more. Sorry. Yeah, I'm not going to think about it. Okay, the secret of the beekeeper's talking. No. It's okay, so I became a beekeeper, and bees have their own personalities. Hives will have different personalities. Some of them are really nice, and some of them are really mean. And I would sometimes wear the suit, but a lot of times I wouldn't because it's really hot. It's summer. And so a lot of times I would just wear like cutoffs and a baseball cap and gloves. I ran about 300 hives for a while, and I might get stung 8 times a day, something like that. Sometimes, like, I remember once I popped the top on this one hive, and I was wearing a baseball cap. And then they have smokers. You've seen those on the nature programs? They never work. They always go out when you need them. You put it in the back of your truck, you drive to the next site, since you're driving along, the smoker actually starts working and it catches your bee suit on fire. And then, of course, when you need it, it's nothing. So I was working with this friend of mine once. The bees, like, I opened the top on this one and it made this cartoon arrow straight in my head. And so I tell this friend of mine, grab the smoker. And she grabs the smoker and starts puffing air. I'm like, which just makes me even more mad. No smoke and thing, of course. So it's like, I don't care. Just light my hair on fire. It's something. And then I end up running into the woods and rolling around. So sometimes they sting, but usually it wasn't such a bad deal. You know, nobody actually knows this, but people say busy as a bee. That's crap. In the lingo of bee research, bees spend most of their time, their lingo, loafing. We'll hang out in the cell and just hang. And bees can do different jobs. It's pretty cool. There's nurse bees, there's foragers, there's scouts, and they steal from each other all the time. There's guard bees. They'll walk back and forth on the front of the hive, and they smell everybody who comes in. If they smell like this hive, they can come in, or if they've got honey, they can come in. Otherwise, they won't let them in. And the males can go anywhere they want. Males is kind of cool. Males have a great life. They don't do anything, and they just get to eat and go wherever they want. And the only two drawbacks. One is that you get killed in the fall, which is kind of great. And the other one is that the only reason that drones hang around is when the queen flies out to mate, she flies up as fast and high as she can, and the drones will follow her, and then the drone who can fly the fastest and highest catches her and gets to mate with her. And the drawback of that is when he mates with her, his genitals explode and dies. It might not be a bad way to go, you know, I don't know. This is all getting the secret. No, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to get right at the edge of the secret, and then it's going to be a beekeeper. Like, reach out. You're going to see someone with one of those bee gloves. Reach out, and they're going to shoot me in the back. That's like how it goes. Okay. The way they make a new hive is by making a new queen. They make new queens by feeding them special food. 10,000, 20,000 bees in a hive. They'll make another queen, and then half the bees will take off somewhere else, and they'll land, like, in a tree or land wherever. And I'm sure you've seen that on the nature programs too. You'll see some beekeeper get in and get them all down. And the secret that beekeepers don't want you to know is that when bees swarm, they don't sting. This fact has been used by countless beekeepers to impress upon others their ostensible courage at virtually no risk. When I was staying with Glenn and Susan, they received numerous calls from around town requesting they pick up swarms. My friends were busy. I was always glad to go, in part because it meant a free bee colony, and in part because it meant an opportunity to show off. I went once on a call from Motel at a main intersection of Modesto. It was near noon and hot. The street was crowded with cars, but no pedestrians went near the basketball-sized bundle of bees that hung from the branch of a waist-high bush. It should have taken me less than 5 minutes to pick up the swarm. I needed only to put a box beneath it, give the branch a hard shake, dislodge the cluster, cover the box, and go. But but as I approached, wearing cuffs, no shirt, and baseball cap, and as the loose bees at the edge of the swarm started to fly around my head, people began lining the plate glass to the front of the motel's office. Traffic started to back up as drivers rubbernecked to see this death-defying young man step into a cloud of crazed bees. I made it take a half an hour. When I got back to my friend's house, Glenn asked what took so long. He said, there's a lot of people there. Smiling, he said, showtime. And twice, though, I was stung, collecting swarms. One time, see, since they're not going to sting when they swarm, they a lot of times go way up in trees. For obviously, they don't want to get eaten. So what I would do is I would shinny up the tree with a big canvas bag tucked in the belt of my pants. And then I would get up there, and then I would get a climb out of the branch, and I would scrape them into the bag. And then for obvious reasons, I didn't want to put the opening of the bag inside my pants. And so I would clamp it between my teeth, and I'd climb down. One time I bit on a bee, or stung it right here. It's really hard to swear when you're holding a bag of bees. And the other time I got stung when I was doing this was really just unforgivably rude on my part. There were bees way up in a tree, like 60 feet up in a tree. The first branch was about 12 feet, so I put a ladder there, climbed up the ladder, climbed up the tree, realized they were too far out for me to reach. So I climbed back down, I attached two long pieces of wood to the bag so I could hold it open like this, and then open and close it by opening and closing this piece of wood. And I climbed back up and realized that if I did this, holding the pieces of wood like this, I couldn't hold on to the tree. So I climbed back down and got some rope, trying to see where the story's going. And I tied myself to the tree. And I start scraping. Oh no, I'm sorry, I had three pieces of wood, because I had the two pieces of wood that were opening shut. I had another piece of wood to scrape. Scrape them off the branch. So I'm doing this an hour and a half, and they're not cooperating. So finally I get an even worse idea, which is I'm gonna saw off this limb, and then the bees will fall to the ground and break their cluster before they hit the ground. I'll recluster somewhere that's easier for me to get. So I saw it off, and the branch falls about 5 feet and lands on the next branch down. Like, well, that's a drag. Mm-hmm. So I climb down, tie myself back in, start scraping again, and the bees, they've been flying around my head the whole time, just trying to figure out what is this jerk doing. And suddenly, in one moment, they went from looking at me to going, you know what, we don't usually sting when we swarm, but I think we'll make an exception. And suddenly I had hundreds of bees in my hair, my mouth, on my nose, on my eyelids, in my ears. I start to climb down, and I realized I'm tied to a tree. So I just had this image of somebody coming over to my house 6 months later and seeing this skeleton on the tree and going, I don't get it. What's the story here? Fortunately, I've always been really bad at tying knots, so I push out from the tree as hard as I can, and I sort of shimmy out, and I push away from the tree and do a control fall, you know, just sort of slapping my arms and legs with all the branches on the way down. And then I hit the ground, roll, run into the house, and put my head under the water in the bathtub, and then I realized I had a really bad head. So what I realized about that is that it didn't take me long to realize what I'd done wrong. Wu wei, which is a Chinese term meaning not doing. Not in terms of doing nothing, but in terms of not forcing. I had attempted to force it. I was no longer working with the bees, helping them into a new home, but instead I was determined to capture these bees no matter their desires. And I was willing to saw a perfectly good limb from the tree for no unselfish reason. No wonder the bees got mad. The tree was probably cheering them on. The whole incident seemed to me a tangible manifestation of the consequences of an unwillingness to listen, of disobeying fundamental rules of neighborly compliance, and on the bees' part, reasonable resistance to insanity. I apologized to the swarm and to the tree and let the swarm go wherever it wanted. So I'd like to read two short sections. These are two of my favorite sections of the book. If words alone could bring down our culture, I would write them. If actions by themselves would stop the atrocities, I would do it. If a change of heart would bring back the salmon, I would change my heart again and again and again. It is not enough at this point, necessary as they say, but not sufficient, to merely right ourselves from trauma, to dismantle the walls they so laboriously and necessarily constructed to constrict our broken hearts, and then try to pick up the shredded and scattered fragments of our experience to reassemble like a precious vase that won't quite go back together no matter how we try. Or better, like the lifeless body of a loved one who was never coming back. The dog going blind from my travel in my truck so many years ago eventually was hit by a train. Focused only on me and a friend farther along the way, she never knew what hit her, but merely tumbled off the tracks and the tall weeds by the side. I ran into her, found her, picked her up, and could not believe she was dead until I saw the gash that split her back and belly. White flesh that never had time to bleed. There was nothing I could do except hurl sobs at my stupidity for taking a blind dog for a walk on railroad tracks, and I wish that just this once I could go back to before, this time to a right. In our case, too, seeing the mistake after it's done is not enough. Nor is wishing it away. Nor, especially in this case, is grieving. When I took her for that walk, I found myself wandering far ahead of this ancient arthritic old puppy. I worried about a train, but not over much, because we were in the midst of a long straightaway, at the far end of which, beyond the dog, was a tight curve. When I saw a train round this corner, I began to run toward the dog, not because I knew to run, but for the joy of running. Then I saw the train had more speed than I'd anticipated, and I ran faster than I ever had. And then I saw it tumble into space. What do you do? What do you feel? When you see destruction rushing down steel rails towards someone you love, you see that nothing you can do will stop it. You may be a fast runner, but you cannot outrun a train. I have read that while every culture has invented comedy, tragedies are the unique invention of civilizations. A hero, doomed, stupid, blind to his own faults, false and inexorable before a fate which can neither comprehend nor avoid. I can try to make right those parts inside of me which have never been made wrong, and I can grieve losses both inside and out, and I can try for all my life to improve my relationship with those around me, human and non-human alike. I can even accept that the oncoming train will most likely crush us, or rather continue to crush us, and will stop only through the weight of our bodies and the gumming of its gears by our flesh. But I will not give up. I know in my bones what it's like to sit stone-faced and frozen in the face of inevitable evil. I know in my flesh what it's like to lie down and take it. I know also what it's like to resist. I know that I'm no longer a child, faced with only the options of a child. I know that I'm now an adult. I know that at long last, it's time I begin to act like one. It's time for me to find better.